Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, May 13th, 2013, and this is podcast number 313. And my name is Ben Stone. Today, we have a very special treat. Yesterday, I spoke with Kyle Bennett on the telephone, actually on Skype. And so we recorded that, and that's today's podcast. So with no further ado, here is my interview with Kyle Bennett. Okay, with me messing around on the phone here is Kyle Bennett, and you might know Kyle. If you don't know Kyle Bennett, you might want to check out a link I'll put in today's show notes for an Agorist Manifesto and 95 Thesis, and you might want to just print that out and get some tacks and put it up on somebody's door. Now, that's probably not very not adhering to the zero aggression principle to do that, but... but you might be inspired to do that after you read it. Kyle, welcome to the Bad Quaker Show.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
And our plan here for the listeners, our plan here today is just to kind of chat about stuff, and we don't really have a plan. We're just going to talk about stuff and see what comes up. Kyle, you wrote a really good thing not long ago on Bitcoins, and I published it on Bad Quaker, and a lot of other people did too. And then it was like 2 days or 3 days later or something like that, and Bitcoins, the bottom just fell out from underneath them. And all these people, you know, I could see it all over the internet. They were like, we were waiting for that so we can point and say, I told you so. And then it came right back to, you know, about $100, where it seems to be a floor, and it seems to go up and down, but that seems to be the the natural landing spot of an average, somewhere about 100.
Yeah, it settled down quite a bit after that crash, and I'm sure a lot of those people were disappointed it didn't go straight to zero, that it ended up stopping with some real significant value still. But it's still volatile, but it's a lot less than it was, and it's not bubbling like it was.
Well, I think maybe the best aspect of it going through that cycle is Jeffrey Tucker made the statement, I don't know if it was on this podcast or if it was just when I was talking to him, that that the problem with Bitcoins is that you have like 13-year-old girls in the lunchroom at school trading them. and as long as you have that kind of it's something that's faddish, and it's not really for a purpose. It's all fun and speculation and crazy. Everybody's wanting to be hip because they have Bitcoins. When that burns off, and then we get to see who the real Bitcoin holders are, and we get more and more people who are interested in doing business with Bitcoins, then we'll see what the real value is. And that's kind of what we're seeing now.
Right. And that's kind of one of the standard curses of the libertarian mission, or really of anything innovative, is that the people who are serious about it have to kind of ride out the fads, where it goes nuts for a while, people get all the hype about it, then you have to hear about the hype and counter it, and then it fades, but for you it still goes on. And now once the hype is gone, it goes on in a way that's more sane and more of a steady build. So I think we'll see Bitcoin, gradually now more sanely building, like you said, more business, not speculation. And one day it'll be something that'll be real to most people without being a fad.
I think also, and I've probably said this before, but I think also people need to keep in mind that, you know, when PayPal started, it was very small. It was pretty much just a tool of eBay, and it was very limited. And now I have a card in my pocket that I could go to a gas station and buy gas with my eBay account, I mean, with my PayPal account. Mm-hmm. You know, and in the long run of things, from where it went, what was that, like late 90s, where PayPal was nothing but a tool of eBay, until last year when they issued me a card, that's a very short period of time in the greater scheme of things. And Bitcoin is moving way faster in acceptance than PayPal did at first.
Yeah, it probably is. And what you point out there, even eBay, if you remember the huge eBay hype when it was on Oprah and everything, and that's all gone now. And I imagine there's a lot of people out there that think eBay has faded away, but it's actually bigger than it's ever been. And it is a multi-billion dollar economy. And there are people who make money who don't sell on eBay. There are people who make money off of selling services to eBay sellers, and people who make money selling services to those people. It's huge. But the hype makes it seem like, oh, well, it disappeared.
Mm-hmm. I really long for the day, and I think it's coming. It's sometimes I don't have the patience to wait for it, but I really long for the days when things like, whether it's Bitcoin or whatever, things like that start to become more and more mainstream, and more people understand that it's just not necessary to depend on, you know, state-backed systems for everything that we do.
And that's the real power of it. As a payment system, compared to things like PayPal, it has some advantages in the fact that you don't have to go through a central authority, and it's a little bit easier. But there's not a huge market demand for just another payment service. But where the real power is that it allows people to take control of their own payments and their own way of handling those. And it breaks that reliance on centralization and on the state, even for people who don't care about that.
Yeah, and that's really where you know you're starting to win, when people are doing it not for some theoretical cause. Like, I mean, that's why I support it, because there's a reason behind it, and I believe in that reason. But when you start seeing people, merchants, utilizing the service just simply because it's less cumbersome than the others, there's little or no fee in the exchange, mm-hmm. as according to how you do it. But those things make sense to businessmen really quick. A businessman with an entrepreneur, with a good sense of direction in business, will spot variations in the market like that, and they'll say, look, if I'm dealing with Visa, I'm going to have to pay this fee on every single transaction. And if I'm dealing with PayPal, here's that fee again. But mm-hmm. I can do this directly with my own wallet and a little bit of maintenance, and I can pay myself, and you know, by not paying those other people. And merchants jump on that kind of stuff pretty quickly.
Right. And customers do, because, well, merchants, for one thing, because of the lack of chargebacks. That's a huge bane for people who sell by PayPal, eBay sellers and the like. That's, chargebacks is a horrible thing, and their PayPal tends to basically take the payer's word for it. And, you know, they might do an investigation, but they might freeze the account for 30 days while they're doing it. So merchants will like that can't be done. I think where you'll see Bitcoin adoption is probably more, not the U.S. might be the last place that it really gets big, because you'll see it in Eastern Europe and Asia and the Third World, because they don't have access to the same kinds of payment systems we do, and because international stuff is still very difficult, even with PayPal.
Yeah, that's true. And even, if nothing else, even exchange rates are a little clumsy in PayPal.
Right, right. And there's a lot of transactional friction doing international payments through those kinds of systems. And that's where Bitcoin really shines, is in the international stuff.
Did you buy? No, I know you did, because I saw you link to it in Facebook. You saw that article. Actually, I think I linked off of your link. The article where some reporter printed out a 3D printer printed out one of these guns yeah. and went through the channel with it.
Yeah. And apparently, I guess in Europe, the security for the trains is comparable to our airport security in terms of how stringent it is.
My comment on that was that let's see them try to put the genie back in that bottle.
Yeah, right. And that's the beauty of these kinds of things like Bitcoin and you know, 3D printed guns, and there's some other things here and there, is that they completely went around the whole notion of let's ask for permission. I know there's a lot of talk in Bitcoin now of getting it regulated, which is still a lot of the more mainstream businesses feel that that's necessary, but it was established first and then asked permission to the extent that it is being asked.
I think it's funny, and I could be wrong on this, but my understanding with Cody Wilson, the inventor of the 3D printed gun, it's my understanding that I believe the State Department sent him a cease and desist letter through the mail, and he received that first, and then I think, if I understood correctly, he got a phone call from them. But if that's correct, the irony, I don't even think I can say it, the irony of sending him a letter in the mail.
Yes, that's one of the things that they don't get and the general public doesn't get is that we're on internet time.
Yeah.
This gun was, he released the file and within minutes it was all over the world, everywhere. And they send stuff through snail mail, which takes 3 days at best. And they're going to be playing catch up on this stuff forever.
Yeah, it's not the kind of thing. I mean, okay, so you tell Cody that, and Cody immediately complies, right? Because he doesn't want his door kicked in, so he immediately complies.
But and because his purpose is served already.
Yeah, exactly.
He accomplished it.
Yeah, and from what I've heard in Cody talking about it, you know, that was his whole purpose, was not so much that he desperately wanted to get a gun out there into the public, because anybody can go in their garage in a couple hours, you can make a gun if you have just the slightest bit of skills with hand tools at all. It's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. But that's not the point. The point is, you know, a twofold that I can see. First off, we all of us together, everybody who's listening to this right now, can do things on the internet at a speed that the governments of the world can do nothing about.
Right. They can't even, they don't seem to even be aware of that, how the asymmetry in speed and responsiveness there and flexibility.
Yeah, this is a new power that individual humans have that governments of the world, not only can they not, not stop it, but they can't even grasp how deadly a power this is that is in the hands of individuals.
Yeah, if you look at history of the major milestone technological advancements, particularly in the areas of communication and transportation, they've always led to more freedom in that they've undermined the central power over those things. You know, the printing press basically killed the church's exclusive monopoly on the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And the automobile basically killed the control over place, over where people were. Now they could be completely mobile. And this is, you know, this is another, the internet, I'm saying, is another advance on that level of the printing press, the steam engine, the automobile. The computer was a big advance, but it by itself, it wasn't, that much of a tectonic shift. The internet is. The internet is an entirely new era in history.
And I should mention, whenever I bring this up around people who are, you know, really strong supporters of government, they'll always say something like, well, but you know, without the government, you wouldn't have had the internet. And I'm stunned at that whenever they use that as an excuse, because I always think, you know, as soon as I had two computers, the first thing I wanted to do was make them talk to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like natural, like, rats, I wish I could just communicate between these two computers. I've got them in different rooms. If there was just a way to wire them together, you know? And then immediately I started trying to find out how I could do that. And I, unfortunately, I decided also that it was a lot of, you know, I was working with some old apples, and that was a long time ago. And I decided the easiest thing to do was to sell the apples and do something else.
I mean, they're right in that it was people working for government agencies that invented the, you know, the underlying protocols and stuff. But as you say, somebody would have invented some protocol, and TCP, which is the core way the internet works, is a notoriously buggy and fragile system. There might have been a better one, because it was people who did that. The government didn't do it. Individual people did it with maybe government money and government facilities, but the government doesn't do those things. The government appropriates the resources that do those things.
Yeah.
And the resources are there without the government.
If you think about everything that you're aware of in your day-to-day life, everything that the government does, you know, whether it's keeping cars registered and issuing license plates or keeping your grandma's Social Security check flowing or whatever, you know, whatever that you, however you encounter government on a day-to-day basis, you have to understand how much layers of inefficiency are built in, that some of it you see when you go to something like a Social Security office or a, you know, a Department of Motor Vehicles office or something like that. Sometimes you get a glimpse at the layers of inefficiency, but most of the time I think a lot of people don't realize just how horribly cumbersome government is and how wastefully expensive everything it does becomes just by the sheer fact that it's doing it, not contracting it to somebody else. And a lot of people in government realize this, and they try to contract as many things as possible. And that does make government a little bit more efficient, but it also provides opportunities for corruption. Anytime you have layers and layers of contractors like that getting free tax money, then you also have the opportunity for corruption. So it's a never-ending cycle where government is always the worst choice about doing whatever the task is.
Yeah, and that the point you made about layering is important, because it's easy to see, oh, I have to wait in a long line or at the DMV, or, you know, this person behind the counter is being lazy and not working efficiently. But when you're dealing with government being involved in so much stuff, it even in the things that are nominally private market, like your grocery store, if you think of all the layers of inefficiency that those goods had to go through to get to those shelves, it might be, you know, 80% of the cost is due to government, you know, the 20 layers it had to go through, each middleman taking their cut. And, you know, you have to wonder what prices would be like, what things like GDP. I'm not a fan of that as a metric, but it's a, you know, it's a way to discuss the aggregate of economic activity, what that would be like without all that waste at every layer along the way.
Yeah. I used to, as a lot of the listeners already know, I used to be in the aerospace industry and spent quite a bit of time in there. And the company that I worked for, General Electric Aircraft Engines, the trend coming into the 2000s, there was a lot of belt tightening and there was a lot of layoffs and so forth. And something that a lot of people at GE, and I'm sure this was industry-wide, it wasn't just the one company, but a lot of people at GE started to realize that rather than this big, giant Leviathan company doing simple tasks, it was a lot more efficient to hire basically a mom-and-pop operation to do little things. So, for instance, little things like mowing the lawns around the grounds. You know, they would hire local contractors to mow the lawns.
Right.
Here's one of the largest, at the time, one of the largest employers in the world who's having to hire a local contractor to mow their lawn. Because it was so much easier to hire a local contractor than it was to go through all the hoops of paperwork to hire people and pay them union wages and all the different things that had to be done to get somebody to mow the lawn. It was cheaper for them to just hire a local contractor. And to a large degree, all of that was waste that was built in the system that GE had to deal with, largely because of government regulations and all the different things that they had to do. And it was a lot easier for GE to do this, you know, than a smaller company that didn't have whole, you know, warehouses full of attorneys going over everything constantly to keep GE safe from lawsuits. But still, it's one of the most cumbersome things for a company like that. And the only way that a bigger company like that can survive is by contracting out all of its little stuff.
Yeah, and there's if you were to factor in the entire cost of the entire pyramid of management that rested on top of the guy who mows the lawn, who's a GE employee, you know, it probably costs $20,000 every time he mows the lawn, where you can contract the mom and pop people for $500, depending on the size of your lawn. I don't know how big a lawn they had.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. But part of the reason was because the higher up you get in management in a company like that, not just singling out GE, but I've been in several, you know, major corporations like that. And the higher up you get, the less likely somebody is to put their neck on the line to make a hard decision to do something. They'd rather, you know, push it off on a committee or let somebody else make the decision, because they don't want to take the blame if anything bad happens, and they know they're not going to get any real recognition if something good happens.
Right. But there's also a rational reason for wanting to be conservative in making those kinds of decisions at that level that's not entirely due to poor character or not wanting to take blame, is that somebody at the top of the pyramid makes decision, even something as seemingly innocuous as how to get the lawn mowed. That decision affects thousands and thousands of people. And when you're making those kinds of decisions, when you have that kind of power, it's sane. Not that everybody in power is sane, but it's sane to be very conservative about making changes. Because a very tiny wrong mistake can cost a lot of money. If, on the other hand, you've got the guy who's in charge of the particular facility deciding to mow the lawn, that doesn't affect the people in China that are working for GE.
Right.
And that's one of the flaws of centralized power, is that when you've got this pyramid at where somebody at the top has to make a decision about mowing lawns, you've coupled, you know, the Shanghai facility with the Ohio facility. You've coupled them together now, and that's a fragile and expensive way to operate.
Yeah, and we're picking on corporations here, and specifically the one. But if you can take that and now imagine if you took away the whole profit motive, and you realize that if GE could work like a government, where they just decide, well, you know what, we need more funds, so we're either just going to loan it to ourselves, or we're going to just increase taxes and take it from people. One way or the other, they're just going to take it. Mm-hmm. So any motivation whatsoever towards efficiency or toward profit or all that vanishes, and you're just left with all of the very worst aspects of everything we just described, in addition to the fact that there's no limits to it.
Yeah, there's no feedback. And this gets a little bit into Hayek's information problem, is that once you have that kind of power where you can basically get around the constraints that resources put on you, you suddenly lose sight. You have no way of knowing what the consequences are of what you did. Even if you want to be conscientious, you don't know how to be.
Yeah, because it's removed from your toolbox, so to speak. You don't have that as an opportunity to do that. And there's actually, you know, punishment built into the system. If in government, if you're the one guy, well, we could kind of see this in a Ron Paul situation. If you're the one guy who really cares, oh, no, we can't overspend. We've got to, you know, keep things within a budget. We can't just add one thing on top of another to a bill and then just push it through because, you know, you have a point A in the bill that absolutely has to be passed. Otherwise, bad things are going to happen. So you put B, C, D, E, F, G, H, you put them all on that bill because point A has to go through. And then the good guy comes along and says, no, I'm not going to vote for that because it's got all that garbage attached to it.
Right.
Well, then now there's a punishment mechanism to pick out that one honest politician and, you know, either destroy him personally, destroy his career, limit his power or influence. So it actually goes back and punishes the guy who's honest and tries to do that.
Sure. And the fact is he did vote against the thing that was supposedly the important thing that had to be done. He voted against that. He caused this supposedly really important thing to not happen. So it's a rock and a hard place. And again, this is a software term, but I go back to the coupling. You've coupled this important feature that you need, say let's save grandma part of the bill or whatever, with, the mayonnaise museum. And now you've made them the same thing. And so there is no right answer. Assuming that the save the grandma thing is something you believe should legitimately be done, there is no right answer. You can't vote for just one or the other.
Flipping back to the corporate side of that, I'm sure you're familiar with Clippy, the Microsoft.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The demon that infected Microsoft for so many years. You couldn't get pretty much any useful Microsoft program without having Clippy constantly yep. agitating you and trying to cause you to go crazy and go postal at work or whatever.
He's still a joke. I mean, it hasn't been in any Microsoft software for, 10 years? And it's still a running joke.
Some things you just can't get away with. But we shouldn't forget things like that, actually, because that's a good example of exactly the processes that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And, Microsoft is another example. I don't want to get too much into the Microsoft battle, but, they chose to design a system that is monolithic, where everything is combined together. And so once you get Clippy in there, now it's very hard to take him out because there's so much else that's connected to it. Whereas something like Linux is relatively small pieces that can interact, but they're not bound together.
Go ahead.
No, go on. I was
just going to compare the two systems, and you could put it, you could put Apple in there just as easy, but picking on Microsoft, what you do have is something that is centrally planned. It's centrally planned, and it's brought in. It has specific advantages in the marketplace because of government laws and government regulations and government preferences, where large programs, government based programs, have bought Microsoft products. And then you have Linux out there, which is decentralized, which is invented constantly. There's constant innovation being done. There's mm-hmm. constantly somebody sitting at a computer somewhere going, you know what, this needs this, and I'm going to make this.
Right.
And so you have something that's constantly evolving and developing and changing, as opposed to a top-down, centrally planned thing that gets issued to us every few years. And then, in essence, we're forced to take it because it's put on everything. You have almost no choice in the matter because of the market advantages that the government gives to Microsoft.
And there's a deeper dynamic in play, too, is that because of the design choice of making a monolithic system, let's say Microsoft, some miracle happens, and they decide they're going to go open source and they're going to let everybody contribute. Like Linux is. They're going to go with that decentralized model. That can't be done within the design of Windows. Because if somebody wants to make a tool that, is, some kind of addition to Word or something, they have to coordinate that with probably 1,000 other developers that all use those libraries and use different pieces of it or connect to it. And you couldn't have that decentralized approach if you even tried. And again, it's because of this word coupling, which is the binding together of unrelated pieces, in that you can't change one without it affecting all the rest.
I wonder what a car would be like if it was designed, in a in sort of a Linux-like environment. where you could just go down to the, you know, you go down to the whatever the local parts store is, and you can't afford a whole car, but you can go down and you can buy a scooter, and you pay $300-$400 for a scooter, and then in a couple of months when you can afford it, you buy a second scooter, and just wire them together, you know.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that technologically wiring two scooters together would work, but you know, what if you could order the frame, and there was standard protocols for how an engine plugs into a frame, and maybe there's five or six different ones for different kinds of needs. But you know, anybody can make an engine as long as it has the bolts, holes in this position, and all that. Anybody can make a frame. Anybody can make a drivetrain, and you simply go and you buy a la carte. Well, I can't afford the expensive frame, so I'm just going to buy the cheaper frame and the cheaper engine. But then later on, you go, you know what? I want more safety. I'm going to put all my parts into a nicer frame now. And, of course, if the computerized system was Linux-based where you could plug your laptop into it with a USB port, you know, all of that could be done, and there'd still be ways for the companies to make profits because they're dealing with scarce molecules. So it wouldn't have to be free open source the way Linux is.
Yeah, and going back to corporate flaws, you know, we were picking on GE a minute ago, but it's the same thing with GM or Ford or Chrysler or, you know, Toyota or whoever. They're a giant, massive company. And on a worldwide basis, what you're seeing more and more with automakers is that the individual components are not made by the automaker.
Right.
You know, the radio is not made by the automaker. The seats are not made by the automaker. It's getting to the point of where actual body components are not being made by the automaker. They're basically just an assembler that owns the brand name.
Yeah. But it's still, those are still mostly designed by the automaker as far as I know.
Yeah.
In other words, they're defining the shapes of the body panels and the kinds of seats and the, you know, the brake systems, and they all have their own. You know, you can't put Chrysler brakes on a Chevy car.
Right, and that's all, to a large degree, that's all because there's proprietary, you know, it's intellectual property rights enforced by the government's violence. But what would that be like if I could just set up a company in my garage and start making frames? And yeah. I would know for a fact that my frames would fit the five most popular engines or whatever, you know?
Right.
This is something. Oh, go ahead.
I know one thing it would be like is that within a few months you'd get your door kicked in.
Yeah, in the real world that we face today, that's exactly what would happen. The government wouldn't tolerate it. And a lot of people are, you know, I deal with this all the time too, that, well, we need to just shrink government. Government should be small. Government should be local. And I think it's, is it Bill Buport that referred to that as unicorns? I think it was Bill Buport that referred to that as unicorns, that, you know, a tiny little minarchist government like that is just a figment of the imagination. But even if you have it, some of the most oppressive governments in the world are local.
That's true. And I still, you know, all else being equal, I favor smaller local, more local government over a larger monolithic one. Again, because of that coupling issue, it might be that the government of St. George, Utah is massively oppressive, but at least people in Denver don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, they might be upset about it in terms of, you know, having empathy for the people in St. George, but they're not directly affected by it.
And the nice thing about that is, too, if as long as the, you know, as long as they don't get too oppressive, you can leave. You can get at, you know, you can move to a different place if you want to. In the case of something like the U.S., I've said this before. Under the current circumstances, I can't leave the country. I have to go and apply for permission slips, and because I owe back taxes, they'll deny that permission slip. So right. I'm stuck here. It's exactly as if I'm under house arrest.
Yeah, they don't need a barbed wire Berlin Wall anymore. They have paperwork.
Yeah.
And all the other countries honor it. Even if you could, you know, literally flee across the ocean to somewhere, you know, and use Bitcoin to transfer your money, anywhere you go, those governments are going to honor the U.S. Demands.
Yeah.
in almost all cases. If you look at, I don't know if you know Mike Gogulski.
I don't think so.
Okay, he's an activist. He has a blog called nostate.com, but he made a kind of showy renunciation of his citizenship a couple years ago. Put out YouTube videos of it. He went to Slovenia or Slovakia, I forget. But it took him months of paperwork to get his citizenship renounced. He finally had a video where he ceremonially burned his passport. But the country he was in, they weren't as closely tied to the U.S. as most are, but still, they would not basically, they were making it difficult for him to stay there without some citizenship.
Hmm.
And he finally did some sort of loophole where he got sort of, almost like a traveler's passport thing, where he, I believe now, he is not a citizen of anywhere.
Wow.
But it was quite an ordeal, and he wasn't rich. He didn't owe a lot of taxes. You know, it wasn't like he was trying to get $100 million offshore.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a guy, you know.
I know there's I haven't really looked into it a lot, but there's a lot of people, especially in the private security sector, some people might call mercenaries, that have a tendency to try to get multiple citizenships and try to keep themselves into a position where they can very quickly be in a different country and be there legally, you know, move through the system very, very swiftly.
Right. And that's an important defense mechanism if you can afford it. There's a term for that called jurisdictional arbitrage, which means you can change jurisdictions to suit your needs of the moment. It's one reason why I favor, going back to your smaller local government, it's one reason I do favor secession movements as sort of one of the few inherently political approaches that I think is worthwhile. Because, sure, we might have 50 governments of a wide range of tyrannical inclinations, but you can move around. You can go, well, I like the particular laws in this favor what I'm doing right now. And some other state, okay, the particular laws here favor this other thing I want to do. So that arbitrage is a handy tool. It's just not available to most middle-class people in the U.S.
That was kind of an advantage. Jumping back for a little bit of a history thing here, I always try to fall back on, well, I don't try, I'd end up doing it whether I want to or not. I always fall back on talking about history in one way or another. But that was one of the wonderful things about Europe, like, 500, 700 years ago, is if you were a merchant in one town, one city, and or town, and it started getting weird, the locals started getting out of control, you could just pack up and go to another town. There weren't the restrictions in Europe that we see today, where just moving from place to place, there can be some real difficulties with it. And that helped a lot of those pockets of what were called free cities or free trade areas, where they could grow fairly unrestricted. And sometimes there were even situations where essentially you would have a whole city with no viable government. But then, you know, these things are always temporary. Some tyrant of some kind sees the opportunity and either invades or, you know, rises up through a series of local political maneuverings or whatever. But it's neat that there were little winks of time where moments in the history of those little cities and towns where they would exist for sometimes 30, 40 years with no viable government.
Yeah. And, you know, when you have freedoms that are politically guaranteed, those are always transient. And so the ability to shift with the shifting tide of politics is a really valuable thing. And you could do that back then. There's countless stories of, you know, somebody in such and such a town, things got a little too hot for him. he moved to some other town, and that's where he met up with some guy that made them both famous now, you know, for something they did. So you got not only this ability to move around and adjust, but then you also had this dynamic of transfer of ideas that came along with this mobility that really set up a very a dynamic that really progressed things a lot.
We see something similar to that in the American West, although it's been glamorized and twisted and distorted by the media for, you know, sensational purposes. But
you mean the Wild West, where everybody had a gun and it was almost no violence compared to today?
Yeah, exactly. and of course, that's not what's portrayed in the media and movies and things like that. But that's the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy from the University of Dayton here in Ohio that did a study a few years back on bank robberies in the Old West, and he found out that there were more bank robberies in Dayton, Ohio, nowadays, every year than took place in like a 25-year period. You know, what's typically considered the Old West is from about 1870 or so to about like 1895 or something. And within that time frame, there are more bank robberies in Dayton, Ohio, every year nowadays than there were bank robberies in the entire United States at that time.
And is that per capita?
I think he did the numbers both ways. Okay. And it still came out to that there were more bank robberies now.
Well, and if you think about, you know, the OK Corral, which is sort of the prototype of the how dangerous the Wild West was. But if you think about it, that the reason it was a worldwide story and has persisted for 100 years is that it was so unusual. Nowadays, a couple of cops shooting three guys isn't even a blip on the police blotter. Back then, it was unbelievable to people, and it went worldwide. We're still talking about it 100 years later because it was unusual, not because it was typical.
I think that's critical to understand that, too, because to just restate it a different way, if that happened all the time, why would they report it?
Right.
The fact that we know that it happened means that it's a bizarre event of the time.
Yes, we know the names of individual criminals from 100 years ago.
And just to put one last spin on that particular story with the OK Corral, there were three different groups of individuals involved. Of course, the essential feud that was going on between the Wyatt Earp and his friends and the, was it Clanton? I think it was Clinton.
Clinton and then a couple other friends with a different name.
Yeah. But then there was a third law enforcement person who chose not to get involved in the thing at all that was there present. But the Clantons were deputized. It was essentially three different government-based policing agencies that were having a conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. So the big wild woolly West was different governments competing for local supremacy.
And that's the case with the famous Billy the Kid situation, too. You have two fighting factions that are both government authorized, both deputized in one way or another, maybe not as sheriff's deputies, but they both had some type of government sanctions on their actions, and both of them acting out their violence for the purpose, one side supporting one business, one rancher and the other side supporting the other rancher, but still you're talking about two law enforcement agencies clashing because they couldn't even get their own authorities straightened out.
Yeah. And even then, I mean, how many people did Billy the Kid kill? Was it like 7 or 8 maybe?
Yeah, it was they always say, well, he killed one for each day of his life or whatever. Sorry about the sound effects there.
I don't know if it was that many, was it?
Oh, well, they used to claim that, but as time has progressed, it turns out that it was actually a very small amount that he's been associated with.
Right, and his name went down in history.
Yeah.
A year from now, nobody's going to remember who Adam Lanza is.
Right.
And he killed 26 children in a day.
Yeah.
Because it, as big a story as that was now, it's not an unusual story.
Kyle, before we wrap this up, I probably ought to give you an opportunity to give a shout out to any websites that you want to talk about.
You know, I can't even think of any right now. Badquaker.com. But I've gotten away from frequenting blogs and all that, and even writing my own blog. Facebook is, as much as people demean it, it's really a way to concentrate people who are interested in the same thing that hasn't been around before and isn't really possible with blogs and other things like that. And that's where I spend most of my time lately. So,
well, we do have a common friend who's who we can give a shout out to, and that's Michael Dean over there, Michael, at the Freedom Fiends.
Yeah, he's really something in that his podcast, and now he's on broadcast radio. That's really some amazing stuff.
Yeah,
he's sort of, and he's not real well known even in libertarian circles, but he's really accomplishing quite a bit.
Yeah, he is. And just the other day, he had Cody Wilson. We were talking about it earlier with the 3D gun printer. He had Cody on his radio program talking about it, and I think he's now broadcasting out of three different radio stations plus the internet activity.
Okay, is it three?
I think it's three. It might only be two.
Okay, the one I knew about was in Minnesota, which I believe covers the oil boom areas.
Yeah.
Which could be a really interesting dynamic, because I imagine those people, you know, I'm sure it's not rife with libertarians, but those people are probably a little bit more independent thinkers than most.
Yeah.
It's an interesting phenomenon, too, that I've noticed, is that this oil boom in the Dakotas and to some extent in West Texas is huge as a historical thing. And, you know, they're talking about the U.S. having more oil than Saudi Arabia, but you don't hear about that in the mainstream media at all, ever. It's one of the biggest stories going on right now, and nobody's talking about it.
Jumping back to what we were talking about there with Michael and Nima, looks like three different radio stations, KZFG, KTGO, and WPBQ. One's in Jackson, one's in Jackson, Mississippi. One's in Tioga, North Dakota, and the other is in Fargo, North Dakota, and it covers out over Minnesota and Moorhead and into Canada.
Okay, great. It'll be interesting to see what the ratings do there.
Yeah.
It's hard to predict because he's pretty radical for most people, but on the other hand, he and Nima make a fun, engaging pair to listen to.
Yeah, they really do. They were really on fire yesterday. We're recording this today on Sunday, and they were on the air yesterday on Saturday. Actually, they might be on the air right now as we're talking.
I think it was noon or 2 o'clock, but yeah, it's pretty soon.
Yeah. So they really play off each other well, and Michael has a way. I don't understand how he can do this, but he has a way to get some of the most unusual guests, like with his Gumbo podcast. Yeah. He got on Dick Dale, of all people in the world.
Yeah, he's got a knack for approaching people who seem unapproachable.
Yeah,
if you look at some of the documentary films he's made, they were sort of niche subjects, but he got some of the big names in those subjects. I mean, he interviewed Henry Rollins, I think.
Yeah, and what's his name? Downey Jr. His first name escapes me. Anyway, Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, he got him to do the voiceover for one of his movies.
Yeah, and he's like the big kahuna in Hollywood now. He's probably a gajillionaire after the Iron Man stuff.
Yeah.
But, it's really something. And going back to Cody Wilson, Michael was the first person ever to interview him.
Yeah, and kind of Cody wasn't going to really make a big deal about what he was doing, and Michael convinced him, no, you need to know how to do interviews, and you need to, you know, get out there, and because they're going to be coming at you. You better be prepared for it.
Yeah, and his whole notion of teaching hospital, where he's not only getting guests to, you know, do his show, but he's helping them, and he helped you with your audio, and he helps everybody do better at this, and that benefits him and it benefits them.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, you know, Michael maybe is not, well, I'm not even maybe, he's not known in the liberty circle to the level that he should be because of the amount of work that he's put into it, and the repercussions of that work are not necessarily, you know, vividly obvious to a lot of people, mm-hmm. but it's there. You know, their movie, Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, the movie that he and Nima did, that's really a pretty good movie, and it got out to a lot of people.
Yeah, it did. And, I mean, part of the problem I think he has is that with getting known is that everybody and their uncle does a podcast nowadays in the libertarian movement. But so it's kind of hard to notice when a few people rise above that teeming mass to be much more quality and to accomplish more. People hear, oh, he's a podcaster. Okay, yeah, they're, you know, dime a dozen. And they don't realize the significance of what he's doing because they pigeonhole it.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, thanks for coming on the show with me today.
Right.
And now I'm getting itchy to get over there and see what Michael and Nima are up to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
Yeah, it's great talking to you, too. We chat all the time on Facebook, but it's good to be able to talk to you in real life, too.
Yeah, you too. So,
hey, thanks a lot. Go ahead.
I know your voice really well, but you didn't know mine. So.
No, I remember yours from your interview with Michael.
Oh, okay.
And since we're still recording, folks, you can find that. I'll even put a link in today's show notes. You can find that over at the at Michael Dean's Anarchy Gumbo podcast, and a lot of other really cool podcasts over there that Michael has done.
Yeah, that's a great show. It's an extended interview format. Now it's not at all like the podcast he does with Nima.
Yeah, some of those are like 2 hours and longer.
Yeah.
Well, Kyle, thanks for talking to me, and I'll let you get going. And
all right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye. And thanks for listening in today, folks. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.